I'm gonna open this door.
Hi, welcome, everyone. Today is April 6, 2015, and I open the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. And we're going to start with a public hearing on 2547. Robin, can you please read us the bill?
I'm so sorry.
Representative Hoyle and Representative Gilliam, if you'd like to come up while she's reading the bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2547 directs housing facilities providing support services to register with Oregon Housing Community Services Department, outlines registration requirements and resident notification process. There is a dash one amendment pending. Directs Department of Human Services to convene, it replaces the bill, directs Department of Human Services to convene task force to define housing with services, define consumer rights, set standards for licensure and registration, and define safety standards, specifies task force membership, requires report to Legislative Assembly before December 15, 2015, places moratorium on licensing of housing with services facilities until task force recommendations are adopted, creates provision outlining rights of residents.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Chair Tomei and members of the committee.
Chair Tomei.
Oh, no. I'm just used to that.
Watch out. I might mistreat you.
I would feel at home. Vic Gilliam, State Representative from Silverton. My pleasure to just say a few words about this bill with my friend and co-chair of the Elder Abuse Prevention Task Force that came out of this committee originally many years ago. And just to say that I'm sorry to report that in 2018, I will be 65. But in 2030, it's estimated there will be one in five of us U.S. Americans of that age, which calls for a discussion around issues like the one in this bill, that is, long-term care facilities and facilities being built for folks of this age that may or may not be aware of the issues around long-term care or the potential for future ones. I want to be clear that there is an amendment coming. There's nothing I enjoy more than putting together another task force. But in this case, I believe, having talked to the stakeholders, that the task force is going to be on task, and we believe will meet immediately, and I would say roughly within 6 months, come to you with some solutions, because there are people who want to work it out and come to the table, which has been our history on a lot of elder abuse prevention issues. So this one is a good one. It does need a task force and some input, but we're happy to come this afternoon and tell you that it's a good thing, and I hope that we can move it forward.
Thank you. Val Hoyle, representative for House District 14, West Eugene and Junction City. Colleagues, I'm here in support of House Bill 2547, which is important because, as we have housing with services, so vitally important for people as we have this aging population. But with this new type of facility, we need to understand more clearly what are the rights and responsibilities, not only of the property managers, but what are the rights of the consumers? What are the rights of the tenants? What are the responsibilities of each of the three legs of that stool? When a person comes into housing with services, you know, right now there's no test for acuity level. And as someone ages, their acuity and need of services may get, they may become needier. And who is the person that decides when someone just needs someone to come in and check once a week versus whether or not people are losing, need a higher level of care? Nothing is outlined right now. So I think as a protection for all people involved. The consumer protection, but again, the protection for those people who are managing those properties, we really should have some rules in place, some laws in place, some parameters in place for how to best serve the needs of that population, and have protections for the people managing those properties. Now, there's already legislation. Minnesota went through a process and developed legislation, so this bill is modeled on the legislation developed in how Minnesota regulates their facilities. Right now, this has been talked about in a 49-person housing policy work group. Now, there's a lot of things that 49 people can do, but I don't think it is getting out, I think it's hard for 49 people to come to you in a short period of time with a focused set of recommendations. And what we would like to see, and I think you'll see an amendment, is a task force that prescribes who should sit at that table, a smaller group that can then get to the heart of the issue and get something to happen quickly. The other thing that we would like to see is a moratorium on these types of facilities being built until we understand what the rules and regulations should be. This type of service is really important. We want people in the least restrictive setting as possible. Under the Olmstead Act, that's what's said should be done. But we want to make sure people are in the right type of setting. So we encourage you to support this bill and a task force, and one that actually gets things done, much like, and again, we've had a great support from this committee and the people in this legislature for the Elder Abuse Prevention Task Force, and we'd like to see something similar with this.
Any questions for this panel? Representative Gallegos.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer. I want to, in all seriousness, this is a serious issue, and appreciate your bringing it forward. You're right, the numbers of boomers that will be retiring and getting into this age bracket are going to be exploding, already exploding. But I do want to ask, this is supposed to be a bipartisan effort, this work group that you're involved in. Then I do want to ask the representative from the Christmas Tree District why he's carrying that big stick with it. Looks like a big elephant on the end of that big stick.
Clearly, it was a serious question, Madam Chair. And I would say that, you know, in response, I don't want to be bickering with my co-chair because I get along with her. But I think in some circumstances, 49 folks is too many. Now, when our caucus has 49 next session, I believe we'll see.
Too many. It'll be way too many.
Yes, so just one for Representative Hoyle. Does your amendment actually speak to the fact that in the next iteration with the task force that it maybe is not chaired by someone with diminished acuity that of a certain age who, you know, could for whom this bill possibly at some point in the near future, I think 2018 I heard, be a conflict of interest on any legislation?
Yes, I think if that were to happen, that person would have to declare a conflict of interest.
Okay,
and yes, and I would never ever speak to the motives, intent, or abilities of my colleagues. But I would say that someone may have to declare a conflict of interest if they thought that this would actually apply to them in the near future. At the young age of 51, I've got a few years.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer. So actually, a kind of serious question. It seems pretty prescriptive on the 19 members that will be on their line 13, one child care provider or representative of child care provider, line 2 here, one parent or guardian of an individual under 18 years of age. How do you hold all those positions and make sure that child doesn't turn 19, and how do you do that? I mean, it just seems like there's an awful lot of pieces here that are prescribed, you know, very well, but it might become burdensome to keep that group together with, you know, people quitting and not being able to be replaced. You have to target, you know.
Yeah, so Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Hayden, I think, you know, what we would like to see is something to bring back to you in short order. So a recommendation to come back, and again, I can speak to the experience that we had with the elder abuse prevention work group, which is we get people in a room, come together, they know that they're there to get something done, to bring recommendations. So I think recommendations would come back within by the next, I mean, the goal would be to have something back to you by the next session where you can vote on it. But clearly we want people that have interests that are represented, that can be a voice at that table, but not have the table be so big that you can't get something done. And so if we don't keep it prolonged for an extensive period of time, which is the best thing that could possibly happen, then I believe that wouldn't be an issue.
And I would add, Madam Chair and Representative Hayden, due to the nature of your question, you would be an excellent member of this.
Indeed.
Thank you very much. We've got 12 people to testify in this, but I also see that Representative McLean is here, and I'm assuming it's for your other bill. So we're going to I'm going to close the public hearing on 2547 for now, or suspend it if that's the proper close it. I'm going to open a public hearing on 3148. Representative McLean, you can come up while Robin reads the bill.
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3148 creates wildfire damage housing relief account within the Oregon Housing Fund. Directs Oregon Housing Community Services to administer grants to households at or below 75% federal poverty level for loss of housing due to wildfire. Directs continuous appropriation for funding of wildfire damage housing relief account.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mike McLean. I represent House District 55, which includes rural areas of Klamath County, which suffered devastating wildfires in 2014. One specifically was to a rural community that folks didn't have or had very little means. A lot of it was single wide trailers, mobile homes, and the Moxon Hill fire. What we found from that is that in some of the rural areas of our state, a lot of folks, either because of a lack of insurance and because of poverty, have had a very difficult time recovering from the total loss of their home. And so there's a small gap in services that the state of Oregon can provide. And so what this is designed to do is to create a very small fund which would allow very quick turnaround grants of $5,000 so that folks can reestablish some housing as well as begin to pay the basics of removal of the burnt out remains. The Moxon Hill fire, which destroyed 17 homes in my district, was one that moved very quickly. People were frankly very fortunate to get out with just themselves and their immediate possessions. And so in the matrix of, again, services available, President of the Senate, Peter Courtney, myself, Senator Whitsitt, and Representative Whitsitt all discovered that this would be a very helpful fund to folks who would be in that situation again. So my request to the committee is that I believe that it should have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, that you just move it to Ways and Means where we can figure out where an appropriate funding source is. I won't go into details because I know you have a busy schedule, the Moxon Hill fires or other situations where you have these 5-acre or 1 or 2 acre places with folks that are, this one was east and a little bit north of Chiloquin. And so there are no services to the area. There's no hydrants. There's very little services out there. So when the fire hit, it swept through everything. Finally, a lot of these folks didn't even have permits They couldn't even afford the permits to try to rebuild the county. Thankfully, Klamath County has been working to try to get permits and some basics to these folks, waiving costs. But we do have people in rural areas. They move there, frankly, to be off the grid, away from services and some of the more some of the communities that actually, like Chiloquin and others, that would be the largest town in any vicinity. But we just we need it. Frankly, we've got some folks in rural areas who really don't have much, and when a fire hits, there's just not a whole lot for them in the short term that can help them recover quickly. Now, through the benevolence of a lot of folks in Klamath County, there has been an amazing display of generosity and to help folks keep going, but it sure is not meeting the full need. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions, Representative Parrish.
Thanks, Rep. McClain. Question for you on, like, when we procure fire insurance, is there any way to offset some of these types of losses as part of when we go out for fire insurance every year and say we want to cover a certain amount of private, particularly homes, maybe low-income type housing, or things that are, you know, certain dollar amount to help offset that? I mean, I'm supportive of trying to, if you're asking for general funds, I'd be supportive to do that, but I'm just curious if there's a way to, through the insurance mechanism, to expand what we ask for as part of our insurance as well, so that we have that type of indemnification, coverage, whatever.
Well, Chair Kenny Guyer and Representative Parrish, I hadn't thought of that, but that might be a source. This particular disaster wasn't where it was near some timberlands. There were no protected fire protection districts. But that may be. Obviously, I don't know if we're going to have insurance at $50 million deductible, what's been proposed, whether Oregon should self-insure or not. I don't know, but that might be. I don't think this fund is going to be very big. In fact, if I recall, it was only a couple hundred thousand. The goal of it is to just the Moxon Hill fire was 17 homes, so if you go 17 times 5,000, you know, you're not talking a lot of money. But for $5,000 to just do a quick hit for folks to recover, that would it's needed, frankly. But the source of it, that's a good suggestion. I'll have to.
Yeah, and I'm not opposed to the general fund allocation. I just think if there's also a way that we include those types of property in the rural concern as we think about our insurance and self-insure, however we're going to get there, you know, because I think we go through like Lloyd's of London or something for the insurance. If we have a way to wrap that in, futuristically, it could be, you know, that you have a fund like this, but that also that you have some additional liability dollars, because $5,000 isn't going to get you very far. Even if you lost your, you know, your single wide trailer, the reality is to go buy another one and put it on that land is not a lot if they didn't already have full loss type coverage insurance. So is there a way for some of those types of property owners to be made whole through an insurance? And I'd like to see us explore that.
Representative Hayden.
Chair Kenninger, thank you. So I'm actually looking for a definition of household. When it comes to wildland fire, sometimes the timber resource that's being burnt makes it a little more of a priority than sagebrush. A lot of people live out in the rural communities like where you're from. So are we talking about people that own property, rent property, live in a yurt, live in an RV, live in a tent? What are we talking about?
Section, well, Chair Kenny Guyer, Representative Hayden, Section 1 of the bill describes it as people residing in the state whose federally adjusted gross income for the tax year is roughly 75% of the property guidelines. I'm not sure if we're really looking at much of an extension definition beyond that.
Okay, so that's property owners.
Well, Representative Hayden, yes. You know, I don't think renters would be applicable because they, while they may have suffered personal property loss, the residents, and again, you know, these are 17 homes that some of them predated permitting process. Some of them may not have predated permitting, but just squatted. When you tour it, it's just, it looks like a moonscape. I mean, the fire was so hot and so devastating and so fast but the people we're talking about here are people who don't have the funds. Now, they're applicable for other resources, but they own that piece of property. Okay. And they just don't have the money to be able to bridge, to just even get started with recovery. And what we found is that the resources that the state of Oregon has, county and others available, are for like temporary housing, Red Cross came in, et cetera. But when you're having to figure out how you bring in another, perhaps, mobile home, even a used one, there's requirements now for clearing the site. All that stuff is, you know, and it takes cash. And while the generosity of Klamath County was fantastic, it was, you know, not enough for some folks. And, you know, a couple thousand bucks to bring in pay someone to come in and remove and prep the site is something. Now, again, you know, it's hard to tell in the future. What we know is, looking in the past, we just have a little gap of where people who really don't have much just need a little help.
Thank you.
Representative Parrish?
Thank you. I'll ask one more on the insurance side of this for the personal. You know, in another universe, Mark's family, my husband's family, used to sell manufactured homes. And at some point, when you own your land and you own the manufactured home, the need for homeowners insurance sort of goes away. People who are very low income a lot of times sometimes saw that as a way to have actually more cash. I'm curious, I mean, because the deductible is quite high, particularly, I think, for a lot of those folks on a manufactured home, given that they are not a permanent stick-built facility. That how many of your folks who suffered through this fire actually had a high deductible? Are they having problems meeting their deductible so that they could, and claim that they could have if they had insurance, that they're able to? It seems to me that that's an obstacle, is the insurance deductible, or even if they had insurance, because at some point, if an acre of land in your community is not worth an acre of land in my community in terms of value, so you're talking probably a lot of very low-dollar pieces of property with a low-dollar asset of a home. So for some families, doesn't make sense to have a high cost of a homeowner's insurance if both pieces are paid outright. The domicile, which we used to treat as a trailer, you registered them through DMV, and then the piece of property. Are they able to have people been struggling to meet those deductibles, or did they you have people who didn't have the insurance at all?
Chair Kenny Gow, Representative Parrish, it was both. I believe the majority did not have any insurance.
Okay. Thanks.
So my questions were kind of along the same line. If you know, do you know how many homeowners and renters have fire insurance? Do you have a sense of that?
I don't. In the Moccasin Hill fire, it was a very few had insurance. It's hard to imagine what a community like this looks like. Mm-hmm. But when people meet the definition of this sort of poverty, mm-hmm. and they live in these areas, they aren't necessarily living by the same sort of precautions that
right.
your district lives by.
Right.
And so a lot of these folks want to be left alone,
mm-hmm.
and which makes these areas extra susceptible,
mm-hmm.
Or susceptible to fire risk. So
right.
at any event, I don't have the actual number of the 17 homes that were lost, but I know there were quite a few of them that did not have the cash to even be able to begin this start process, which is why the county went in and started waiving permit fees. And after they got at it, and again, you know, when it comes to the Red Cross and others took care of folks, within the next week, you know, so they weren't living outside. But when you have to, everything's burned and you have to start over according mm-hmm. to current permitting rules, which the state requires, it requires an expense, and none of our current programs pay for that. Mm-hmm. And so as a result, some folks just are stuck. Mm-hmm. And so I think, I think having a fund that could just come in and help people begin the recovery process, if they're in this unique situation outlined here, is needed. My request is send it to Ways and Means and let me work with the co-chairs on finding a source.
Okay. Any further questions? Thank you, Representative McLean. I close the public hearing on 3148. And I will reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2547. We have 12 people signed up, so please limit your comments to 3 minutes, and I'll start waving when you start getting close to that. Can we please first have up David Berger, Melissa Unger, and Phil Bentley?
Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee, thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak with you today. For the record, my name is Melissa Unger, and I'm the political director of SEIU Local 503. And today I'm here to talk to you about House Bill 2547. SEIU represents many different members that work in the long-term care system, from nursing homes to assisted living facilities and over 20,000 home care workers that work for Medicaid consumers. Our members care about the quality of services they provide, their jobs, and the entire system of long-term care. The Housing with Services LLC is a pilot project supported by funding from the Affordable Care Act and other private funding sources. It was officially launched in September 2014 and is serving 1,400 seniors and people with disabilities living in 11 publicly subsidized apartment buildings located primarily in downtown Portland. These projects are serving seniors, families, and other special need populations, all living in publicly subsidized HUD facilities. The focus of these projects is to promote housing stability, improve access to health and social services, improve health outcomes, and reduce health care costs. And SEIU supports all of those goals. We brought this bill forward because we think that offering housing and separately offering wraparound health services in one facility is a new type of care. We, along with other folks, did talk with DHS about this new type of care, and a work group was formed back in January. We started our conversations back in April, May, and June. The work group has had 2 meetings, and right now there's still been no kind of permanent timeline, and that timeline of what the goal of these work group meetings are. And so that's why we felt compelled to bring forward a bill. Some of the questions that we think are really important to answer, and this is what the bill struck out to do when we originally drafted it, was a definition of what housing with services is and what it is not. What are the right safety regulations, like fire safety? What are the right consumer protections for people that are both tenants and a captive audience for services? How do you differentiate between your rights as a tenant and a consumer of services? How do you protect choice in a system where certain service providers are more readily available to people? How do we make sure that long-term care ombudsmen and other resources that people have are a resource for people that need it? And those are just some of the questions that need to be answered throughout this process. This housing setting is different than other low-income housing. For instance, we have home care workers who work in this facility, like in, you know, serve people in the buildings. And right now, if you're a Medicaid consumer, the way you would go about getting a home care worker is you would get your assessment and get a certain number of hours for what kind of assistance you need. You would then find a home care worker. You'd either go to the registry, you'd go to an agency potentially, if a caseworker referred you to an agency. You might choose a friend that you're comfortable with. You might even have a reference from a different friend. And you would employ that home care worker or work through an agency, and that's how you would get it. In the housing setting that's being offered, people come into this facility and they may bring a worker in, or they may be offered services. But then they're there, and they're offered presentations of how the services that are available. You know, and one of our home care workers described it almost kind of like a timeshare presentation, where they're offered lunch, they're told what kind of services they can get. And a consumer can definitely decide not to take those services, but they continue to get the information. So I think I'm being told that I need to wrap up. So I'm just going to say there are going to be Dash 1 amendments, I believe, or Dash a task force. I believe they're not ready yet, and they're not here yet. I think that, but the goal here is we've been asked, and we agree that there needs to be more work done to answer these questions. This original bill was based off of Minnesota law that currently exists, and so we look forward to having that task force. We just hope that there's a timely response to getting regulations set up for this new type of facility. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. My name is Phil Bentley, Senior Vice President for Government Relations with the Oregon Healthcare Association. OHCA represents more than 700 skilled nursing, independent living, licensed residential care, and assisted living communities, as well as licensed in-home care agencies throughout Oregon. In total, our members operate over 25,000 licensed beds and units, in addition to over 12,000 independent living units throughout Oregon. We believe House Bill 2547 seeks to address a number of policy issues that are raised by this new supported housing setting called Housing with Services. And it's really an attempt, or Housing with Services kind of represents a blend between what is just strict independent housing and something more along the lines of assisted living, and falls somewhere in between. And if Housing with Services is here to stay and is a model that will be going forward that our members could avail themselves of, we think it's important that the legislature provides a regulatory framework for this new model of supported senior housing. A regulatory framework will help provide answers to questions around resident safety and consumer protections, and it will help both providers and consumers understand what services they're getting and also what services they're not going to be getting. We believe that the Housing with Services model raises at least five questions that are worthy of consideration by the legislature. Melissa touched on a couple of them, but let me just reiterate that we do think it's important to provide a clear definition of what Housing with Services is, and in that process really delineate it from other types of supported housing, such as those that our members are currently providing. Second, I think it's important for the legislature to determine whether or not there should be consumer protections and disclosures that are associated with this new setting. In our environment, in an assisted living or residential care setting, there's a regulatory framework that defines the relationship between a provider and the resident. For example, the state administrative rules include a comprehensive residence bill of rights that are required to be disclosed to residents. The residents' rights include being treated with dignity and respect, being free from abuse, rights to privacy, the right to participate in their own care plan, and to make choices about the care that they receive. They also inform residents about how to file a grievance with the respective state authorities. Consumer protections and disclosures may be different in the Housing with Services model, but we think these are important questions that need to be answered. And since I'm getting the time signal, I'll just briefly mention that building codes are specialized for assisted living residential care. I think those are questions that need to be asked about fire and life safety protections. Those are all issues that I think the legislature needs to weigh on. Finally, whether or not the long-term care ombudsman services should be extended to these settings, we think is another issue that should be resolved. And finally, there's an issue around acuity. If you're going to have a large number of seniors congregating in a particular housing unit, we need to make sure that they're appropriate for that setting. Thank you.
Thank you. You want to wait to the end of the
I can wait.
All right. Hello, Chair Kenny Geyer and committee members. My name is David Berger, and I am the interim long-term care ombudsman and director of that state agency. I'm here today to talk about some of the proposed amendments that we understand are coming down for House Bill 2547. Those amendments, as I understand them, would take the bill and transform it from an early attempt to define what housing with services is based on Minnesota law to creating a statutory task force to answer some of the important questions that have been raised by the other folks here at the desk with me. I think that having a statutory task force is an important step in terms of defining what housing with services is, understanding where it exists within the context of existing housing options for consumers, including those licensed care settings, and really distinguishing it. And finally, as others have said, making sure that there are adequate consumer protections and disclosures in place. In the draft of the amendments that I've seen, the Long-Term Care Ombudsman's Office is a member of that task force, and we would certainly bring our advocacy and consumer protection lens to that discussion and do our best to make sure that there are good protections for folks in this new model of housing. Thank you very much, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative Gallegos.
Thank you. Thank you for bringing this to us. I have a question. How is this different than, with the standard housing tax credits, we are required to have community services built into the system. How is this an adjunct to that, or how is it different? I'm not following.
Sure. Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Gallegos, I'm not sure if I can fully answer that question, but let me just take a stab at it. I think what's key about housing with services is that you are adding a healthcare-related component. There is additional services rather than just someone being a tenant in an apartment building. They're also being provided services, wraparound services, including healthcare supports and services. So I think that's what makes this somewhat of a unique setting.
So it sounds like then it's a much more intensified or even specialized service for a particular demographic. And so it's focused.
Did you want to answer that too, or should
I? Just Chair Kinnegar and Representative Gallegos. Just one thing is, I think you do have two sets of you have lots of these services are licensed and regulated on their own, and then the housing and the HUD services have their own regulations. And I think the big question is here, as they merge into one setting, what are the right things that should or should not overlap? It is a different kind of way that the services and the housing were originally imagined in their own kind of regulatory settings.
Thank you.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer. Okay, so big ask here. I've been working on a concept of long-term housing services for mentally ill, to where that they could have medical services available to them, kind of a fit between what the counties have to do now and through county jail and through the state hospitals. Would love to develop an idea of a health district or a mental health district where our safety officers or social workers have an option. So would housing with services, now that you're engaging with health, would it be possible to have a mental health aspect to your task force to try and tackle a very, very large problem?
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Hayden. I mean, I think that maybe, I think, would be the right answer. I think the question is whether that fits into this, or that's like a question that the committee should ask and answer, is like what other types of ways could these types of services be useful to different populations of people in mental health. Maybe that's the way that we address it. But I think there's ways that could be addressed, and there's also I think the mental health will come up in the conversation about what types of services are offered. So I think that you could see a way that it could be addressed, or the way that this task force could address other ways that housing with services could serve different populations of people and just not a senior population. I think that might be what you're asking.
Follow-up.
Yep.
Yeah, what I'm asking, or what I'm wondering out loud, is assisted living centers do an excellent job for seniors. Mm-hmm. Why couldn't we take that concept and create assisted living centers for patients that have a diagnosis of mental illness? So I'm not talking about integration. I'm talking about a new concept of an urgent assessment facility where people, once comfortable, could stay long-term.
Chair Kenny Geyer and Representative Hayden. I think that's certainly an option that could be discussed. While I'm relatively new to the models of providing services for the for people with mental illness, my understanding has been is that they have long resisted that type of housing formation and rather have really focused, and their advocacy groups have focused on integrating people into the community at large. Potentially that is something that could happen as part of the housing with services, because these would be integrated communities. In the draft of 2547, without the amendment, housing with services had a long definition, but part of that was 80% of the population meeting an age requirement. So if we look at expanding the scope of services, right now I would suggest that we focus on taking a look at the original intention here, and that is providing services to seniors, seeing how that works, and then taking a look at what those different communities might want and how we make a variety of options available to them.
Yeah, just to follow up, I wasn't talking about mandatory, I was talking about voluntary involvement. Yes,
thank you.
And you're wondering if on the task force there's anyone linked to mental health? Okay. Representative Buehler.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Kingard. Maybe I'm a little slow here, but what problem are we fixing with this?
I'm Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Buehler. I think that right now we're trying to make sure that we don't create a problem that currently doesn't exist, would be the way I would respond to that. Right now I think that there's these facilities, and as I've talked to the advocates and the people who work there, we don't have a problem with the current facilities that exist. The question is, what are the right regulations for those facilities ongoing, and will it be a growing population? So, for instance, in Minnesota and in New Jersey, I believe, and in other states where these have popped up and work, right? Like they provide good services for people, things that we support. The question is just, what are the right types of regulations to make sure they're successful? And I think the big question I ask myself is, as I look at somebody, how do we make sure that somebody who enters this housing situation is aware of their rights, is aware of their rights as a tenant, and then is also aware of their rights as a consumer of services that are being offered in the facility. And so I would say that right now, with the kind of one project that is up and running, there's not a problem we're trying to fix. But what we're trying to say is, as we move forward, and if the goal is to continue to expand these, how are we make sure that we're defining them? How are they different than what already exists? And how do we make sure we're protecting the consumers in the process?
And if I could just add to that, Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Buehler, I would echo Melissa's statements. Mm-hmm. I don't think we're trying to eliminate a valuable service that's currently being provided. I think, but this is something that's new, and whenever we've done that with other supported housing environments, we've sought to make sure that protections are provided, and I don't think that there's anything that we've discussed today that would prevent this model from continuing, but it would provide some clarity for members such as ours who may want to avail themselves of this particular model. And there are risks if you don't know what the rules are, that you could end up, for example, operating an assisted living facility without a license. And there are clear delineations about what types of requirements you have to meet if you're going to do that or not. So I think it's just more about kind of adding some context and clarity around what's currently a little ill-defined within the marketplace.
Okay. Thank you very much. And I will now call up Ruth Gullias, David Fuchs, and Rose Englert. Okay.
Good afternoon, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. My name is Ruth Gullias, and I am CEO of Leading Age Oregon. We are a statewide association of mission-directed and not-for-profit organizations providing quality housing and services. And we're pleased to be here to talk about HB 2547. With me is David Fuchs, who heads up the pilot project in downtown. She's the impetus for this bill. I'm going to speak to the Dash 1 amendments that are not before you, but we understand they're forthcoming and want to address some points of that. We do not support the bill as written, but we support the draft amendments to move forward with a task force. We believe strongly that we need to understand the various models of housing and services out there before we move forward with any, if needed, regulation. It's a complex issue, and lots of models that have been in existence for a long time where people are residing, where they may have moved in there 25 years ago, and now there's older folks living there, and they have been purchasing services and been able to do so for a long time. So we want to make sure that we understand what the issues are before we move forward with anything. We want to make sure that the task force that's appointed is a well-balanced task force comprised of a good mix of housing and services, community services agencies, so that I think it will serve as a really good opportunity for us to learn better from both the housing world and the licensure facility lens world on what those issues are. We also request that the overall orientation of the proposed amendments move from really looking at this as an institutional licensed facility. It is a program of services that are occurring in congregate settings. And that orientation makes a really big difference, I think, in how we view this. The housing and services project downtown, and I think what we're going to see more and more of, is the services have been provided in these settings for a long time. What we're seeing more emphasis on is how do we more purposely integrate services? How do we make sure you have access, how a person that needs services has an access to those services, and we can better facilitate that in order to, and the outcomes that the pilot's doing is to prevent hospitalization, make sure that we're all living better quality lives, being able to access the services that we need. We are in independent housing, not licensed settings. We don't have to choose those services. We oppose and request deletion of the amendment language that states no additional housing facilities will be opened until the recommendation of the work group are formed, with the charge of the work group being to define what housing and services is. We think it's premature and certainly dangerous to stop the development of affordable housing. How can we stop something that we have yet to define? And that is the charge of the work group. Most importantly, we've got a severe lack of affordable housing in Oregon. Oregon Housing and Community Services requires that optional services as a condition of funding. So those projects will continue to move forward and are desperately needed. I am going to finish it up here real quick. There's growing evidence that people residing in subsidized housing have more chronic conditions, and that we need to be supporting interventions to improve health among low-income seniors and not create any unnecessary regulatory framework at this time until we know what it is that we're trying to do. And I thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Fuchs. I'm CEO of Cedars-Sinai Park and the president of the Housing with Services LLC. I want to express my appreciation for some of the things I've heard prior to speaking, particularly Representative Gilliam's comment about the concern that we need to address the growing population of elders in our state. That is a very legitimate concern. And I also want to express my appreciation of the union support for the concept behind our project. We appreciate that very much. However, I think that the frame of what is being presented is inaccurate. Housing with Services came together in an attempt to address the needs of a population already living in affordable housing who were a high-need population, not to create facilities, not to create institutions, but to meet people where they are and to recognize that there are clusters of individuals with high needs that if we do a better job of coordinating their services, we can keep them out of institutions and out of the institutional world and divert them from that and help them to use the healthcare system more effectively. So we are focused on the coordination of services among multiple providers and not dictating to anybody what services they should receive, not doing intakes of individuals coming into the apartments, but bifurcating the health service from the apartment buildings themselves. One of the reasons we created a separate LLC was to make sure that there was sort of a sight and sound separation regarding people's individual health care needs as compared to the relationship between the tenant and the landlord. The landlord should not be in the business of finding out what people's health care condition is if all they need to be able to do is meet the terms of their lease and pay their rent and allow quiet enjoyment. And I think that that difference is a really significant one, and it is falling into the trap of an old paradigm as a new paradigm is emerging to try and fit this kind of model into an institutional frame. Now, Minnesota did do that, but what they were doing was instead of doing assisted living, they called assisted living housing with services. But if you look at Michigan, Vermont, California, New York, New Jersey, these are the Massachusetts, these are the organizations that we participated in a learning collaborative with, none of which are doing this kind of work based on an institutional frame, but a community-based frame. We applaud the idea of a task force, and we support it. However, there, you know, a few other things we need to recognize. Housing with services is an opt-in model. Of the 1,400 residents in the 11 buildings in our project, only 400 thus far are receiving services because that's who's opted in so far. Nobody is required to receive services. There are important questions we need to answer. How is housing services different than other providers? In what ways do we want to operate? In what ways do we want to continue to see Oregon be innovative and responsive? The amendments need to be rewritten, or the amendment needs to be rewritten to take out the institutional language, so we're not trying to define housing with services with a preordained perception that we are building institutions. Second, while we applaud the development of a Bill of Rights, they shouldn't be written as institutional Bill of Rights. HUD requires HUD housers to provide a Bill of Rights already. Let's not reinvent that wheel, but for recipients of service, make sure that they have a Bill of Rights. The roster of representatives should be more broadly representative of people involved in housing, the area agencies on aging, and I would suggest a few consumers who are living in affordable housing might be well heard from as well. And finally, creating a moratorium on something that we haven't defined yet will simply stifle innovation. Let's not stifle innovation. Let's move innovation forward for the sake of making this state a forerunner in what we're doing. I have here, incidentally, a copy of the participants' Bill of Rights, which I'll provide your staff so you have a chance to see that one already exists and is exemplary.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rose Englert. I'm with CARE Oregon. We are a member of the LLC of the Housing with Services. CARE Oregon is a health services and healthcare organization that serves four CCOs in the state, as well as a large population of Medicare members. The reason we got involved with this is partially because of our mission as an organization to get more into the upstream health and to really look at innovative ways of addressing people and keeping them healthy. And also because out of the buildings in the project, approximately 40% of the members at the outset were CARE Oregon members either through Medicare or Medicaid, many of which are duals. So it made sense for us to get involved with this because we already have a lot of these folks as patients. We appreciate that there are some questions around new models. There's always going to be a little bit of concern when new models come forward. I think one of the things to keep in mind is that all of the groups that are involved with the LLC currently are highly regulated groups, as Mr. Fuchs said. We have a number of regulations around what we do, both around the housing, around the services, and around the healthcare that we provide. This is a way for us to better coordinate. I think this is the next step as far as CARE Oregon sees in what CCOs should be doing is coordinating even more services and more care, and we're really excited to be a part of this. You know, as we said as well, that I don't want to repeat what my colleagues have said. We do believe, again, that the task force does need to have sort of a new cast of characters to include health, and very much we absolutely echo the need to have consumers, tenants, members, depending on what lens you're looking through, but the folks who are living in the buildings involved. We think that's a really important part of all these things and something we miss a lot when we're putting task forces and groups together. Also, you know, we we're concerned about the moratorium. We do think it's going to squelch innovation and, you know, taking away opportunities to push forward and actually provide more care, more services to people, to meet them where they are, is actually taking a step backwards. Again, I don't think that anyone is trying to take advantage of anyone. This is, you know, we're all very highly regulated industries and we all have the best interest, but both the proponents of the bill and, I mean, those of us in the Housing with Services group have the best interest of the consumers in mind, and I think that's a really important thing to keep in mind as we're moving forward. I think everything else I wanted to say has been said.
We'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, I don't have a question yet. I mean, I really appreciate, David, your explanation was very helpful, clarifying. And, I'm sure I have questions, but I think they'll get time to germinate. So, thank you.
And we're more than happy to follow up.
Sure. Thank you.
Representative Page. Thank you. So in your current model, have you had, maybe this is a better question for the agencies like DHS, but, you know, level of complaints from people who, existing residents who somehow feel they either aren't getting the best of housing services or aren't getting the best of healthcare services or any other sort of wraparound ancillary services that you're providing? And I ask because what you're trying to accomplish is also being discussed in the veterans community of, can you put people who are, you know, who've earned veteran status into a housing situation, particularly somebody who's low income, and then properly align them with care, you know, that VA care, and put that, in fact, Bill McCormick of McCormick and Schmicks has been very interested in this concept, taking, he actually wants to take the Memorial Coliseum and turn it into one of these facilities. But, you know, so that there is the housing piece and people are free to live and come and go as they want without what's traditional assisted living, where you sort of have a gatekeeper. This model says there's no gatekeeper. It's your, you know, it's your apartment, it's your place to live. But, oh, by the way, there's these other services. So I'm intrigued because I think that there is an opportunity to do the same thing in the veterans community. But I'm also interested, and usually when somebody brings a bill, it's because somebody complained or somebody had a problem or somebody's, you know, raised a red flag. Have those red flags or complaints, is there some complaint-driven issue that's happening that there is this bill coming forward?
Madam Chair, Representative Parrish, as far as I can tell, there have been no complaints. I thought the question earlier about what problem are we trying to solve is a very fair question. The fact is, what we are seeing is people are being responsive to the presence of care navigators and care coordinators, in other words, social worker types and nurses that are available to answer questions and help them to access service. They're being responsive to the service providers that are culturally specific, that are able to speak their languages. For somebody who speaks Farsi to have a Farsi-speaking care manager that says this is how you can access services better, or somebody who speaks Chinese speaking to a Chinese resident saying here's how you can access services is of great value. We're seeing instances where we have a social work student who's part of the project, where there was an individual who went to see a doctor in the clinic that we helped to set up. The doctor recognized that this individual needed to get to the hospital right away as a result of a blood test. Our social work student provided the transportation for that individual. He required a full transfusion, and she's been following up with this individual because he didn't have a phone, and it was her advocacy that helped him to get the telephone so he could get services more effectively. Those are the kinds of things that are happening, and there's, you know, and they're only happening for the people who are willing to say, yes, I want these services. What they would complain about is if the landlord was getting their private health information. And we've got a very high barrier between that. First of all of the health providers operate under HIPAA regulation, so they don't share that information. We look, the Housing and Services Project only looks at aggregate data to be able to see what's necessary, and then the care managers and other services providers involved have to adhere to the HIPAA regulation. As a result, the landlords are not informed about individual issues, but what they can do is they can say, gee, this individual's gait has changed. There's something going on, or I'm worried about this person, and they will make a referral, and then somebody will reach out and see if there's a service need. And incidentally, if there's an existing provider relationship, we want to honor that. We're delighted if somebody has a a home care provider that's from the union or goes to a doctor that's not the doctor that operates in our clinic. We don't care about that. All we care about is that people get the health care in a timely manner and don't use the emergency room for routine health care and can stay out of the hospital.
Only if it's really quick, because I'm aware that there's six more people after this and then a number on the next bill.
So the real quick follow-up, when you said you don't care necessarily who's providing the care, whether they're union or not, how do you contract out? As the landlord, do you contract out then with providers who say, you know, you make that available to sort of all comers? Is that an RFP process? Or, I mean, what does that look like?
I want to be really clear. The landlord does not contract at all.
Okay.
The landlord simply has, and first of all, of course, all of the HUD buildings are required to make some services available, and there are service coordinators in those buildings. Those service coordinators might contact us. There are 9 organizations that came together to create the Housing with Services Project, but we are open to multiple others who have stepped forward and have expressed a desire to provide services. So we are welcoming virtually any comer who's a legitimate organization. Metropolitan Family Services said, we have a care coordination model. Could we be involved with you? We said, of course. One of the dental hygiene schools said, we'd like to do dental screening. We provided the opportunity for that. PACE co-located with us. They're not a member of the LLC, but they said, we'd like to locate in your clinic to make PACE services more easily available for people who are part of these buildings. So what's happening is there's a magnetism to the idea of coordination. You know, I started out in human services, God, in the Pleistocene era, about 42 years ago. And when I first got into this business, the first director of the first agency I went to work for said, welcome to this crazy business. And I worked in mental health. I thought he meant the clients. What he meant was the silos that we create about how to provide services. This is breaking down those silos. And part of the concern I have about framing as institutionally based is it's just another expression of another set of silos. We're about home and community-based services. We're about going to where people are and providing services where they live. Glad to regulate it. Let's regulate it on what is the best practice of doing that, not create another set of institutions and institutional rules and try and fit a square peg into a round hole.
All right, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So next, can we put in John Miller, Rachel Duke, and Mike McCormick?
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today on this bill. My name is John Miller, and I'm here representing Oregon Opportunity Network. We're the statewide association of community development and affordable housing nonprofits. Oregon's board recently added HB 2547 to our priority agenda with an opposed position to this bill. Based on our concerns about the bill, both as originally written and as amended, as we've reviewed. The bill, as it's currently written, Representative Gallegos astutely points out, is extremely broad. Many of our members do all sorts of services, and the way it's written now, all of our members would be required to register with the state, and so we feel that that's a huge overreach that probably wasn't actually intended within the initial drafting. But then also, we like lots of many elements of the amendment, particularly assigning a task force to come up with the rules that would regulate this type of model. We are definitely opposed to the moratorium on building any further housing based on an undefined model that, as we've already discussed. So now we really feel is not the time to move Oregon backward from the promising health and housing integration for which we're rapidly becoming a national model. I know many folks are looking to Oregon as a leader in this field, and we feel like we've done an excellent job so far, and we definitely don't want to slow down that good work. Our members as nonprofits providing affordable housing have always provided health and wellness programs as part of the resident services in their buildings. Everything from foot care for seniors to on-site clinics to exercise and nutrition classes to helping folks access insurance coverage and navigate their health care options. These services are totally voluntary and aren't in any way, shape, or form an assisted living medical model. Instead, they're programs that, when linked directly with partners in the healthcare system, make better use of public dollars, improve access for low-income residents, and make people's lives healthier and better. Rachel Duke from Home Forward is with me today, and she's going to share some examples from Home Forward. Several of our members and partners are currently serving on the stakeholder work group convened by DHS to study housing with services model, including HUD Field Officer Director Margaret Salazar, as well as Organon members Amanda Saul from Enterprise, Dan Belliere from REACH, and Rachel Duke from Home Forward. So there are those folks are already on the committee. We do recommend really looking at the membership of the new committee that will be convened and making sure that there are the right folks on that committee. We believe that an open, comprehensive conversation among the diverse stakeholders in the work group is the best way to build a shared understanding and to explore whether new regulation is needed around the housing with services model at all, and if it is needed, what those regulations might be. So we respectfully ask that you direct DHS to give the work group a clearly defined charge, including establishment of a clear, shared understanding of the housing with services model, as well as health-related resident services provided in affordable housing, and then a report back to you for action in 2016. As long as the work group has a clear charge and goals with the right people at the table, a good facilitation and a deadline, we feel confident that can bring back thoughtful recommendations for your consideration next session. Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee, thanks for having me. Thanks very much for having me. My name is Rachel Duke. I'm the Supportive Housing Program Director at Home Forward, and actually what that means is my job is to find ways to integrate housing and healthcare. So what we're here talking about today is super important to me and to everyone here, I'm sure, but I think about it all the time. We provide housing assistance for 15, Home Forward is the housing authority that serves Multnomah County. We provide housing assistance for 15,000 households throughout the county, and that's over 33,000 residents, includes more than 9,000 rent assistance vouchers like Section 8 or the VASH vouchers that support veterans, as well as housing, public housing and housing that we have acquired and developed. All of our portfolio has the potential to be impacted by this House bill. Since 1979, we have been working with community-based health services as well as other important community resources to successfully house Multnomah County residents who need low-income housing. Not everybody, this includes actually a partnership with HUD focused on, for the last 35 years, focused on aging seniors, wrapping community services around housing. So this idea of bringing healthcare resources into housing is not a new idea. This is a great model that we're super excited to participate in with Cedars-Sinai, but the idea of integrating services and housing is not something new, and it's something that we've been super involved in for a long time because we feel like it's one of the best ways as an organization that we can support our residents. Our residents sometimes don't need anything but housing, but sometimes, like all of us, they might need more than just a roof over their head. So it's important that we're finding ways to link with community resources and do a good job at helping them access things. So as a housing provider, our job is to manage the buildings well. They're assets that we care about. It's important for us to manage the leases. We have services staff, mm-hmm. and our services staff, really what they do is they focus on helping people connect to community-based resources. Again, we're a housing agency. We don't provide services, but we know that those services need to exist for many of our folks so that they can be successful. A good current example, I've cut so much out because it's so repetitious, and plus I don't want you to cut me off. But one current example is a high-rise in Northeast Portland called Hollywood East, and this is a high-rise that's long worked with various service agencies and in partnership with agencies committing to supporting residents. And when agencies make that commitment, it allows us to open our doors a little bit wider. It allows us to maybe reduce our screening criteria. If we know someone's connected to an agency, we know they're going to get assistance, and so we can house folks who are hard to house. This is one of the four buildings that Home Forward owns that's participating in the Housing with Services project. What that does is it brings some healthcare navigation on site and some mental health services on site. Why that's awesome is because we have one service coordinator in that building and there's 300 residents there. And so what this does is extends her reach. She knows that for someone who has an, for example, in this case, there was a resident who was unable to access resources to control his diabetes. Certainly very life-changing for this person to be able to connect up with a service, the care coordinator on site, access the insulin and the equipment he needed to use to manage his illness, and then to be able to stay housed successfully
independently in our building, which we take care of.
Rachel, if you could wrap up.
And I'm wrapping up right now to say that as a participant in the DHS work group, we want to have a conversation that asks how we can achieve more partnerships and opportunities that benefit our residents. We want to make their lives better. We want a planful and thoughtful discussion on increasing resources that we know are badly needed in our community. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mike McCormick. I'm the Director for the Aging and People with Disabilities Program within the Department of Human Services. My testimony will be brief. As you've heard this afternoon, this is a very complex issue. The department started hearing from advocates and stakeholders back about a year ago about the concerns, very real and very sincere concerns, about what consumer protections should be in place for seniors and people with disabilities who receive services through some kind of housing with services facility. Their concern was 100% sincere. After a few months, when things slowed down, we started a very broad stakeholder process. We've had two meetings which have been primarily foundational in nature, and really trying to get the different parties that participate in this to gain an understanding of what happens in each of these facilities, what are the regulatory structures under each of them. So the reason why we started the stakeholder group was because we have a desire to reach consensus recommendations on what those consumer protections should be, if any. The timeline we were working under was to report back in 2017. The department has seen the draft amendment language and is, you know, officially neutral. And, you know, I'm available to answer any questions you have.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Under current laws, you know, so how I'm envisioning this, and I need to probably go out and tour one of these facilities, but I would be glad to do so after the session's over. But under the current laws, if you are in housing that's affordable housing, there's federal laws that say you can and can't do this with tenants. And under the current laws, if you are receiving care from like a care organ or some type of service CC or whatever, there's a bunch of laws that say, oh, by the way, you have to treat a patient this way. And so when you match the two up together, there's a lot of protections, I would assume, between the healthcare laws and the housing laws that protect somebody who is low income in this housing receiving these types of ancillary services as part of their housing. Were there actual complaints from residents directed to your organization that somebody didn't get this right? Because it seems like there's already a lot of protection. Yeah, under the healthcare laws and under the housing laws.
Madam Chair, Representative Parrish, I didn't receive any official complaints that I can recall. I think the stakeholder group, which is very sincere in their desire, was trying to be proactive on this issue. What if their condition worsens? The services provider associated with the housing complex going to step up and provide an increased level of services to that individual? Or are they going to be evicted from a place they consider their home to go to some kind of facility with less independence? Do consumers know that they have a right to choose who provides their services, what kind of disclosures are made to consumers? So they really wanted to get ahead of the issue and not react when a problem arose.
Can I follow up real quick? Yeah. Again, I want to go point to the way the current laws are around health care and patient rights and housing and patient rights. So what I'm hearing you say is, in absence of a work group or in absence of a change to the law to add increased consumer protections, do you not feel, in your opinion, that the current laws protect a patient's rights around what kind of health care? I would assume that, like a family care, since I'll pick on them since they came and testified, that if they're delivering health care services and then somebody is not getting proper services, that the liability currently falls to them, not necessarily the landlord in this case. And if the landlord is sort of a slumlord and isn't paying attention to people the right way, that the law would apply to them. They're like, it sort of makes sense that maybe there's a need for a bridge, but it's, as I look at and have looked at this and at people on both sides have asked me to look at it, there are adequate safeguards in my mind on the healthcare side and on the housing side. I'd be happy to see us maybe just bridge that together somehow, but I feel like there is rights already on both sides for a patient and for somebody who, you know, receiving care this way but also gets housing this way, that both sets of laws are really strong in how they treat the individual based on sort of the silo they're in.
Madam Chair, Representative Parrish, I think I agree with everything you just said. However, simply having protections in place does not guarantee that all of the right protections are in place. So the stakeholder process is going to be, you know, somewhat laborious and detailed in looking at, you know, the different scenarios. What if this happens? What are the types of consumer protections, you know, should be in place? And really to make sure that it's complete. That's the goal of the stakeholder group that we're operating.
I was just going to say that that's my understanding of it, too, because in the old world, you had people with, you've been doing some services, but it's filling a gap. So previously, you have people in housing, and maybe because there weren't a lot of services provided, when their acuity increased, their families maybe put them in assisted living, because that was the other option. This is now filling a gap, and so one of the questions is, as people get worse and worse, they're being helped by these services, but at what point do they really need to go to a more increased care? And I think it's because it's filling this gap that they're trying to figure that out.
And I guess my follow-up question, to speak to what you just said and to kind of take this one step further, if I lived in my own home and family care was coming and providing me some kind of services, right? Somebody came and provided my grandmother services when she was old. How is that any different than living over here in this universe where I live in the house, I'm paying rent, it's sort of like my own place, even though you've aggregated it, but what isn't, so basically what I'm hearing is if we're worried about that for this population because they live in this type of housing, you should be worried for it about for anybody who lives in any type of housing because they're disconnected in that way. We already are providing health care services, I guess. So if we're worried about it for just this one type of model of housing and not the rest of it, then something else is wrong in the health care system if that determination, because my family would, if I lived in one of these facilities, hopefully my boys will step up if I'm paying rent. And say it's time for mom to move on, but they'd be having that conversation whether I live here, which I'm paying rent for, or whether I'm living here and paying rent for, and the services are being provided one way or the other. I mean, I just see this as a consolidation of the ability to reach all of those people in one unit instead of having people have to run all over town and, you know, hell and gone to get to see the next patient. They're seeing them over here. So in my mind, there's really almost no difference, and I'm trying to wrap my head around that.
But my guess is just that there's more of an expectation when there's a big thing about coordinated services. There may be more expectation. But I think that's what we're trying to explore. It's kind of a new packaging of services, and I think the concern is just to make sure that we're not creating gaps. So please respond, and does anyone else want to ask questions on this? I do want to make sure we get to our last panel and then the next bill.
Respond?
Sure.
Madam Chair, Representative Parrish, I think the distinction would be if I owned the apartment complex in which you live and I own the in-home agency that that serves your apartment complex, both are under a separate set of regulations, but the combination is kind of like a new emerging model. And, you know, Have you been informed of choice in that situation, that you don't need to use my in-home agency, that you can use a private home care worker, you can use Addis home care? You know, it really, so that was, you know, one of the arguments that was made to me by the stakeholder community.
Okay, Representative Bueller, do you have a question? Nope. Okay, thank you so much. And I'm going to call the last panel. Allison McIntosh, mm-hmm. John Mullen, and Janet Bird, please.
Hi. Chair Kenny-Geyer, members of the committee, my name is Allison McIntosh, and I'm the Government Relations and Communications Liaison for Oregon Housing and Community Services. I just wanted to come up very briefly and let you know that Oregon Housing and Community Services staff are participating in the work group that DHS has convened. We have one staff member who's participating in both the work group and the steering committee, and his regular job is to try to connect housing with other services in the state, so CCOs, early learning councils, other places where people have a need for affordable housing. And so he's working to coordinate also internally as well with staff that have expertise in multifamily development and ongoing compliance. Oregon Housing and Community Services, as you know from previous discussions, is really working to increase partnerships with other state agencies and ensure that housing that we're developing with public resources is making sure that it's meeting other needs. And just lastly, I would say we're happy to continue to participate in whatever iteration the work group goes forward in and discuss these really important issues. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, John Mullen from the Oregon Law Center. I don't want to repeat a lot of what's been said, a lot of good information here today, but I just want to point out a couple of things for purposes of illustration. We've had basically three revolutions in Medicaid in the state, and the very first one was the long-term care revolution that happened in the early 80s. And during that time, adult foster homes were created by the state without regulation, and Clackamas County, where I worked, in Multnomah County, felt that there needed to be some safeguards for people living in these houses that provided services to five or fewer people. Eventually, there was state law that was passed based on that. When the assisted living facility concept first hit the state, nobody was entirely sure what it was. There wasn't very much in the way of regulatory devices. I'm not in favor of regulation at every level and for everything. But when you have people who are vulnerable living in particular kinds of levels of care, housing projects, there needs to be some safeguards. For the people who are working with Cedars-Sinai, I've known David and Howard for decades. They're very good, honorable people. This is a project that involves three landlords, 11 buildings, and 9 service providers. What a number of us as advocates were concerned about, and when we heard that there was also a state innovation model grant that the state helped to facilitate as a way of providing some additional assistance to this project. Again, this is a terrific project, but in the future, we want to make sure that anything that we do that is housing with services in the broadest sense, not something that's more generic or something that people receive at home, where the state has a role, because we really don't want to have a situation where there's a scandal involving people receiving substandard services and substandard housing. And so I think this is the reason to have this kind of legitimate discussion. And so I would just say that we support the idea of a stakeholder group, whether it's the existing one or another one is created. There are a number of questions in the proposed amendments and in the discussion today that I think will help us hone what that stakeholder group should do. One final thing I'll mention is that I strongly believe there should be somebody from the legal aid community associated with this because of expertise in not only things like residential rights, but also landlord-tenant law. And thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Janet Bird. I'm here today representing the Housing Alliance, which, as you know, is a coalition of organizations across the state concerned with creating housing opportunity. The Housing Alliance is neutral on this bill. We do recognize that it's really important that we solve this issue, that we figure out both how to meet the needs of our elders going forward, and also that we get better at creatively melding the resources that we have at our disposal to serve people. And so we're supportive of the idea of a task force to iron out these questions. I did want to say that we're pretty concerned about the question of a moratorium on development going forward while the task force irons out these details. As you heard last week from Housing and Community Services, they have just issued a notice of funding availability for a pretty substantial amount of resource, that those decisions would be being made in the next 6 months. We would hate to see those resources held back while the task force did its work. And so I just really want to share with you the concern about the moratorium. Again, you know, we recognize that there are a lot of very complicated issues to work out about how we merge these resources going forward, how we blend healthcare with services, healthcare with housing, but a moratorium is very concerning. So thank you for your time today.
Any questions? Would either of you like to comment on the moratorium?
The task force is very popular.
Yes.
The harder question is the moratorium.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, what I would think would be something that we would want to keep in check, at least for the time being, is the making funds available from the state, like additional, if there are additional things like the state Medicaid, the state innovation model grants that are available through Centers for Medicaid and Medicare. Basically, that would be an opportunity for the state to say, we know what housing with services is, and so we're going to put funding into it. I think before the state puts additional funding into projects like this, and I'm meaning, when I'm talking about the state, I'm talking about the Department of Human Services and the long-term care, aging and people with disabilities. I'm not talking about housing and community services and NOFA requirements. That's the only cautionary note I would put out there, but I wouldn't want to describe it as a moratorium, but just rather a caution about spending state dollars for a model that has not totally been defined yet.
All right. I think that's the last panel. No one else on that one? Yep. I will thank you, everyone. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2547 and open a public hearing on 2756. Robin, could you please read us the bill?
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2756 directs Department of Human Services to adopt rules to define practical knowledge and skills required for caregivers in licensed residential facilities and adult foster care homes. There is a dash one amendment pending, which replaces the bill, directs Department of Human Services to convene work group to study training of direct care staff, outlines task force membership and outcomes, required report to legislature no later than December 1st, 2015, declares emergency effective on passage.
Okay, great. Eva Ripito, Melissa Unger, Leslie Sutton are the first three out of seven. If you can also keep it to 3 minutes, knowing that we'll probably have questions. Then we'll get out of here by five.
Excellent. Thank you, Chair Kenny-Geyer and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Eva Ripito. I'm political coordinator with AFSCME Council 75. AFSCME represents workers in private nonprofit group homes for individuals with intellectual or developmental disabilities, the state-run stabilization and crisis unit homes, as well as licensed in-home child care providers who provide inclusive care. AFSCME originally asked for HB 2756 to be drafted because we were seeking a solution to cut down on turnover due to what some of our members see as inconsistencies in trainings that they are required to receive. These are for the group home workers. Mm-hmm. Proper training is essential for this workforce. They need to know how to give proper behavioral support and what to do to address medical needs of their clients. Not knowing how to properly do their job can lead to a worker being investigated for neglect or abuse, leaving them out of work for the time that it takes for the investigation to be done. It also means that the people who need consistent quality care see higher turnover in the people providing their care. I mean, everybody wants to know who their caregiver is, no matter what kind of setting, so I think that that's hugely important. In conversations with Leslie Sutton and other advocates, an agreement was reached to look at training provided to the entire workforce along the lifespan. It was suggested to make HB 2756 a task force to look at trainings for caregivers and others who support individuals with IDD from birth throughout their lives. In the dash one amendments, you'll notice that we've attempted to have representation from all the various types of care for individuals with IDD. We also included early intervention, child care, and education to make sure that everyone who provides services or supports to an individual has the training they need to help their clients or students succeed. It is important to include all the people who do the various types of work because they know firsthand what they need and what they currently don't get. We'll need a dash two amendment. They've already been requested. When I was coordinating the dash one amendments, I mistakenly excluded personal support workers. And as you will hear, there are around 8,000 personal support workers in the state, and their voice should also be included in this task force. So thank you again for the opportunity, and I welcome any questions.
Yeah.
Chair Kinnegayer, members of the committee, my name is Leslie Sutton, and I'm with the Oregon Developmental Disabilities Coalition. We're a coalition of about 30 organizations that work to improve the lives of people with developmental disabilities through promoting quality services and equality in community integration. We believe everybody benefits when a person with a disability has the supports they need to live a healthy, fulfilling life as a member of their community. We support House Bill 2756 as amended to include a task force on training of individuals who support people with developmental disabilities. A highly trained staff is a key piece of a person's life when they're looking to be a member of their community. And you've heard from many people with developmental disabilities in this session alone and in previous sessions about what that means to them. It is a critical thing about how they live in their community and how they can be a part of their community, and staff is truly important for that. In preparation for today's testimony, I did ask several family members and also self-advocates what a highly trained staff person means to them. You know, what is it when it works perfectly? And they said, it's great, I get to have my life. And I said, well, what happens when you don't have that? And they said, everybody suffers, it's hard, the relationship doesn't work, I don't get to do the things I want to do, and we all have problems. So I think this really truly is a critical thing to be discussing now. Oregon is facing a support worker training crisis. Training differs across the system and across the lifespan. Right now, it depends on how you're getting your services, how your support workers are trained. And because of this, we believe that Oregon is not prepared to take into the future the training needs of people with developmental disabilities so that they can have the staff that they want. And as we talk about what's happening in the future, looking forward, Oregonians with IDD and their family, they have evolving support needs. They want to live and work as members of their community, and new federal rules support these goals by requiring that home and community-based services be actually delivered in a most integrated setting with access to the greater community. Oregonians with IDD deserve the professional and highly trained workforce to help this happen for them. As I've mentioned, the training crisis does span the whole system, and the impact is really enormous on people. And that's why we have such a broad task force list. I mean, it is big, we admit that. But when you're looking at how large the developmental disability system is, it does span a lifespan, and it spans a lot of different places where people are. So that's why we have so many people on the task force. I do hear from families that say that their support workers aren't trained to support their children in the community. And because of that, their kids are being segregated elsewhere. And
Leslie,
finally,
if you could wrap up.
Sure.
Thank
providers
you.
And other groups have recognized that this is an issue. My colleagues that will follow me have a lot of detail about possible solutions that the task force will be looking into, and many more details. So I would defer to them for that information. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Kinnegayer, members of the committee, I'm happy to testify twice on task force today. My name's Melissa Unger, and I am the
This could be a busy year for you.
Michael 503. We represent approximately 8,000 personal support workers who support people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. We also represent adult foster care providers and people who work in group homes. So we have a broad interest in this bill, and we support the amendments when personal support workers are added into the amendments, which they currently are not in there. One thing I do want to note is we currently are actually trying to have this whole conversation around home care workers generally. So personal support workers work under the Oregon Home Care Commission, and the other Oregon home care workers care for seniors and people with disabilities. And we actually want to have a broad conversation about what are the right certification needs, training needs for home care workers overall, because we believe that the Oregon Home Care Commission plays an important role in making sure that folks do have the right training. We think that it's appropriate to have two separate conversations, because this task force represents a broad group of different types of workers who serve these needs, but we want to make sure that the two conversations are linked so that the two tables don't come up with different ideas about how to proceed. And so making sure that we work with the department to make sure that if we are able to successfully have these two conversations, that they're linked, because the need for home care workers who care for seniors and people with disabilities and people with developmental disabilities is growing, and it's not going to stop growing. And we need to make sure that we have the right training, the right recruitment plans, and the right career ladder workforce development plans for all of these workers to make it successful. So we're really hoping that these different tables where we talk about this can create a long-term plan for these workers who have an integral role in serving for care and support for all of these people.
Okay, questions for this panel? Thank you very much. I'll call up now Chris Burnett, Joanne Farquhar, sorry, I'm getting that wrong. Fern, and Maren Gibson, please.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Chris Burnett. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Rehabilitation Association. We represent approximately 65 community agencies across Oregon who serve individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. We are here to support the probably -2 amendments that include PSWs and the broad swath of stakeholders for this task force. Leslie already addressed, and others before me addressed, the direct care workforce crisis, and I think you've heard that in other testimony throughout session, that we are really facing that workforce crisis across the spectrum of care. The good news is there are industry experts who are ahead of us and have thoroughly researched the need for a consistent curriculum and credentialing process for direct care workers. And so there is really current research and recommendations on how we could map this process going forward and templates. And I don't often get to sit in front of a legislature and say CMS will help pay for it, but they actually will. They will help fund the ongoing training of direct support professionals. So Aura has already reached out to some of the authors of this research, and they've been to Oregon. We've met with ODDS Director Tennedy, and as well as we've brought in the online tool, College of Direct Support, the agency that, or the organization that owns that software, and we've had conversations with, as I said, the director of DD, and they see the connection, they see the value of a consistent and credible and evidence-based curriculum and credentialing. And it really is about reducing turnover, increasing retention. That's quality for the individual served, and it's also a professional career path for DSPs and personal support workers of all kinds to stay in this profession and to thrive and to advance in a professional career. So I'm kind of skipping over a lot of things that are in the testimony, but really you'll hear more specifics of the value of this kind of training. And some key components are that online training tool from the College of Direct Support, as well as the curriculum and credentialing model that is part of the National Alliance of Direct Support Professionals. We've been working with them for over a year. They've done extensive trainings all throughout Oregon, and Joanne's agency, Partners in Community Living, has done something quite unique in Oregon, and she'll tell you about that. So that is, I will share the reports and research. I don't want to go into all that now, but there is some really good stuff out there, and the fact that CMS will help pay for it is a pretty big deal. So, but we support the task force.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Kate Geiner, Vice Chair Stark, thank you for your time today. I appreciate you listening to our concerns. I'm also here to support House Bill 2756 as amended, and just want to talk a little bit about the importance of training and coordinating training in the lives of the people we support and what it means to have well-trained, committed direct support professionals there for them. So our organization, Partnerships in Community Living, has we've been around for about 28 years. So we serve over 200 families, people, children and adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities in about 8 counties throughout Oregon. We employ 800 employees, the vast majority of those as direct support professionals. So there are lots of things contributing to our crisis, our workforce crisis right now, wages being one of them. I know that's another committee, but go ahead and pass that on.
And then we're on that committee. A couple of us are on that committee too, yeah.
Training is a huge part of it. And we figured early on that the way to keep well-trained staff and the way to provide quality services to invest in training. So we've been really early adopters to that. And what we've
we've found it over the years, there's a variety of places that's training required in our system, right? And it's administrative nightmare sometimes trying to figure it out. So I love the idea of bringing it all together and finding a streamlined place. But we've just created our own system since there wasn't one set way to do it. And it's really paid off for us. So while our organization, we experience a turnover rate about 25%, which is not perfect and not exactly where we want to go, but it's better than most throughout the state, which is, so they cover, depending on who you talk to, between 60 and 80%, some much more than that. And I really attribute that to the investment that we've made in training. We talked about, and then most recently, we've been involved in the College of Drug Supports at an organization called the National Alliance of Drug Support Professionals, who has a credentialing process, which is not free and which is not cheap. But again, we decided that if we need to make an investment into our employees and try to create stability for the people we support, that we wanted to do that. So we have a 25-person cohort that we've started, and I'll let Maren can go into more detail about that. But what I will tell you is just we've been about 3 months into this, and what I've seen is already an increased engagement from those employees. They're all still here, which is sometimes that's great, you know, just to know someone's here. They're committed. They're interested. They are excited that we care about their future and that we're creating a career path for them, which in the end results in better services and a better life for the people of support, which ultimately is our goal and what's most important to us. And then I won't today, I will tell you, as I was writing this testimony, one of our DSP cohorts who's going through the credentialing popped into my office. She happened to be there. I was just sending this off to get printed and thanked me and said, thank you for creating such a great place for me to work, and thank you for letting me be part of this cohort. I'm learning something, and I already feel like I'm doing a better job. I'll get a little emotional about it because it's those kind of things that keep me going when we deal with the struggle of hiring and retaining employees. So we are excited to be part of this, and hopefully we can take what we've learned and apply it across the state.
Thank you, and I think we may have missed your name at the beginning. Can you state it again?
Joanne Furman.
Thank you. Both of us are on the subcommittee, Representative Stark and I, and we have certainly heard about the incredibly rapid turnover in the sector, in large part because of due to the low wages. So it's good to know that at least in part it can be mitigated by training. I know that's not the whole picture.
It isn't, but it's an important piece.
But it's an important piece of valuing and giving people the tools they need to do their job well and feel good about it. So thank you. Right.
Thank you.
Hello, Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee. My name is Maren Gibson. I'm a direct support professional. I've worked for PCL for over 12 years now. And I tell you what, I love what I do, and I love it because it's been a lifetime. I have a sister with Down syndrome, and so I'm kind of just like passionately committed. But what do I do is a whole nother thing. I have explained it to some members, and it really just depends on the person in front of you, and it's really hard to become knowledgeable about that. If a person needs extensive medical support, you know, with catheters or with physical therapy or, you know, speech language therapy, or if this person is extremely volatile and aggressive, you know, it's DSPs that are there to support them in that. And I can honestly say now I'm a great, great staff, but it's been because for 12 years I've failed and tried longer and harder and differently and eventually ended up successful. But it took years and years and years of just failing and trying again to get that training that I needed. And I'm involved in this NADSP credentialing, and it's amazing to see how much staff are just waiting to soak up what we have to offer them. We want more. We want to know more. We want more ideas. And our agency does a great job providing us with more, I think, more than anybody in the state. But still, we're still questioning. I mean, we do things that police officers do, that nurses do, that life coaches do, that financial advisors do. You know, we don't have the training of any of those people. And so it's been really fun to be involved with this credentialing cohort as a pilot because they're just ready and waiting, you know. And I know one person specifically, I've worked with her for 12 years, and she's kind of had a fascination with emergency services, which can be detrimental and costly. And so how we handled that for 11 years was we would drive by fire stations and wave to try to create a positive, relationship. And I went by and visited her 3 nights ago, and her entire living room is caked with pictures of her with the firemen and pictures of her with the fire trucks. And this staff that is in our credentialing actually did some of the online schooling and recognized that we were missing a connection here. She feels connected to emergency services. So instead of calling 911 now and harming herself and trying to commit suicide, we just go for a daily visit, and she knows the firefighters, and they know her. And this is because of this one staff, you know. So I've literally watched this person, this woman, lose 100 pounds and stop using emergency services because of one staff's approach with her. Wow. And so, and I'm a good staff, and I know what I'm doing, and I didn't try that with her for 11 years. Mm. You know, so it really is just that knowledge and having the ability to think outside the box and to get greater experience and skill set with it. And so just, you know, what I've recognized and understood is that it's about relationships. We try to teach people skills, and we try to force these skills at them, and really they need to experience life for themselves so they can gain these skills for themselves. And ultimately, when people are happier, they're easier to support, and it's easier on our state and everybody involved.
That's fantastic. Any questions? Yes?
Yes.
Okay. I thought that meant that.
You know, I'll be quite honest with you. This discussion just really frustrates the hell out of me. Why isn't this discussion being held in the higher education, the workforce development committee, where we can talk about, you know, career paths, we can talk about training, we can talk about, what we talk about in there is high-end salary people, high-end training for engineers and specialists and so on. And it's like, we want to train them because they can get high salaries, they can pay taxes. And, you know, people in human services don't make any money, so, you know, why bother with them? And like I said, this just really frustrates me. And the fact that this area of service has totally forever been underpaid. Yeah. I mean, so anything we can do, I think, is what's really needed, and to really respect and value the work that you folks do. I mean, it's just critical. So, sorry.
Representative Hayden?
Thank you. I want to comment. I can't agree more, not to challenge the 40-40-20, but there is more need out there, and it could really engage with education, and it could really be helpful. So I agree.
Well, I agree completely. I think it's probably why we're all the Human Services Committee. The work you do is so valuable. Thank you, all of you, for doing it, and Maren in particular, for being on the front lines. It really shows how the value that you feel in your work when you know you've helped someone.
So thanks for hearing us.
Thank you for having done that for 11 years.
Yes, I love it.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for your time.
Okay, and Tricia Smith. Mm-hmm.
Good work.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, and I'm here today to briefly offer my testimony in support of House Bill 2756 and its -1 amendments. You will see in the amendments that there is an educational assistant as a task force member, and that's because an OSEA, we represent 20,000 members who work in K-12 and ESDs, Community College Head Start. About 40% of our membership are educational assistants, and the vast majority of those folks are direct care and instructors of our students who have intellectual and developmental disabilities. They work in 197 school districts and 20 ESDs and Head Start associations, and the training of those folks is the responsibility of their employers. There was a time when in K-12 we had a statewide effort to provide best practices training at all levels and for all educators in our school system. Then we've had a couple of recessions since then. And now our once full-time educators, instructional assistants, are often 2 or 3 hour-a-day instructional assistants. And our highly trained instructional assistants are now barely trained instructional assistants. And some of their managers don't understand that this is work that requires a great deal of training in order to provide for the needs of and care of that student and his or her education, which both of those things must happen during the day. We are very happy that this task force is being proposed to you, and we hope that you will look upon it favorably, because we believe that with this huge population of children, our members and their support professionals at home need to understand the same things so that this student can have a continuity of care. We think that we will all be better off when that happens, and we look forward to you moving forward on this legislation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any questions, Patricia? I think the same comments would go for your population as well.
Madam Chair, Representative Gallegos, 10-4, good buddy.
Thank you very much. Okay. All right, committee. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2756. And adjourn the House Committee on Human Services and Housing.
Not even five.
Mm-hmm. Oh, look at that. We're early. Mm-hmm. Oh, look at that. We're early. And housing.
Not even five.